Okay, let's get started. Questions before we get started? Are there any questions?
So Project Wan will be due on CERT.
What?
September CERT.
It's September 5th because September 3rd is a holiday.
So post-homework.
It's like it's assignment zero. It's not project one
assignment
really.
Assignment zero and the project one will be due on 5th.
Ah, sorry. Only one thing that's due next week, which is this list refresher. That's it. Nothing else is due next week. Okay.
All the questions, they're not due.
No. The way the homework things work is I would tell you. Let me show you this. So I just added one question till now. So that's basically, I'm just saying socket open then. And then at some point of time, I say I have added enough questions that I'm going to say this is homework one as a whole. Okay. And then at that point, I'll say socket closed, and I'll give a due date a week from then approximately. And then it'll be due. And then so you send it, give it to us in hard copy, and we grade it and give it back to you. List also is hard copy. Yes. Yeah. Unless the TA, I'll ask TA, you know, for the real project, he would actually give instructions as to, you know, what all you need to submit. In general, you would submit both hard copy and soft copy. Okay.
This time,
I believe it's just hard copy. I'll ask him to send a mail if it's different. Okay. And it will be due next Wednesday because next Monday is a holiday. Other questions? Okay. So, this is crazy. This one is less bright. This is brighter than that, right? I don't know why. Okay. So what we are going to do today essentially is look through the agent architectures, which are these block diagrams that you'll keep seeing over the semester. But today is the first time we'll actually formally show them, and we can use them to actually motivate why we would wind up working on various topics in this course. Okay, and then bulk of the today's class would be problem solving agents, which is chapter three. I think I sent you guys mail. Okay. So last class we talked about the environment, how you know the characteristics of environment can change how hard or easy the problem is going to be, right? So today we are essentially going to look at what needs to go into the agent program such that you can start solving these environments. Okay. So let's see. So in a way, this is like at the bottom of it all you are looking for is an agent, a program, is trying to figure out what is the next action to work on, okay? And now the next action should potentially depend on all the percepts that it has got, all the things that it was able to sense in the environment from the beginning up until now, okay? So presumably, one can say, if you believe, so this is something that we will start talking about as we go forward. If you believe in tabula rasa, which is there is nothing in the agent program other than the sensing that it's getting. So it started as a blank slate. So it has no extra information about the world. In that case, really, the only thing that it could base its decisions on as to what actions it can do is with respect to the sensing, with respect to the percepts it's got. Okay. So we'll talk about the percept history. It's the sequence of percepts that it was able to get, sequence of information that it was able to gather from the environment from its beginning till now. Okay, and in a way you could just say that the action really is going to be, the action that it's going to choose would be some function of this percept sequence. Okay, if on the other hand the agent also has some background knowledge about this world, then it would be a function of the percept sequence and the background knowledge. Okay, so we can start from this. So one idea, the first idea actually, which doesn't even appear here, is to try writing agent programs which just have a big lookup table which say percept sequence 1 action A1, percept sequence 2 action A2, and so on. If the agent only has, you know, five actions, let's say four actions that it can do, go forward, go backward, go left, go right. Let's say these are the only actions it can do. Then ultimately, this is going to be a huge big table. And in this column, it's always be either A1 or A2 or A3 or A4. Or maybe nothing, do nothing. Okay, that could be another action too. Just don't do anything right now. Okay. But as you would have seen if you read the chapter, chapter 2, even for simplest problems, the number of distinct percept sequences are prohibitively large. Okay, so you don't really want to write separate sequences for each separate percept sequence action, an action. If you're trying to build this, so if you're trying to write an agent like this, all you have to do is to build this table. That's it. Once you build this table, then you know the agent essentially indexes into this table and decides what action to do. Okay, now the argument of course is this table is going to be way too large, because many, many percept sequences wind up being essentially equivalent. Okay, and so what you would wind up arguing is the first thing you need to do is, even though you're getting information, percepts from the environment, you first consider converting it into a set of features. Okay, so the idea is that the features are somehow higher level than the percept that you're getting. So in the context of, let's say, the automated taxi driving agent, the sensory information it's getting are essentially things like, you know, the current snapshot of the road in front of me, which could be a 1024 by 1024 image, with each point, each pixel in the image having maybe, you know, 1 to 16 as the levels of brightness. Okay, now you would say that the percept sequence, so you would say that the image has changed if in fact even one of those pixels winds up having a different intensity value. And there's very high chance that for things like a little fly, you know, flying in front of you, you would wind up changing the, you know, percept that you're getting. Okay, that's just one sensor. And then you have the sensors like, you know, you have sensors about the noise, for example. You may be able to, you are using your ears, so to see what kind of sounds are there. And the sound too would be essentially, you know, it's a signal and you're representing that signal in some way. Okay, and it may be that most of the signals are different from each other, and yet as far as this particular problem is concerned, they're very close to each other. Okay, so what you would wind up talking about if you are an automated taxi agent is things like, is there a car to the left of me? Is there a car to the right of me? Is there free space in front of me? Is there somebody in my blind spot probably? These are the things that you want, but they don't sell sensors for those. Okay? So what you would wind up having to do is, at the minimum, convert the sensory information to these higher level features. Okay? If you did that, then your percept sequence would now be, instead of these signals, instead of these different images and different voice signals, it would actually be in terms of, yes, there was a car to the left of me, or there was a car behind me. There was a car behind me. There was a car behind me. There's no car behind me. There's a car. There's no car behind me. Okay. So now I have, in terms of t equal to 0, I had a car behind me in the right-hand lane. Okay. T equal to 1, I still had the car behind me. t equal to 2, I had a car behind me. T equal to 3, suddenly there is no car behind me. Okay? Now, that's the sequence that I'm getting. Those are the kinds of perceptive sequences I'm getting. Now, in this particular case, of course, based on this sequence, you would need to decide what action you're going to do. The big difference, so if you start writing agents like that, they would have boxes like this. Essentially, from the sensors, you get the features and you know the current state of the world. Okay? And if you have the current state of the world, you decide what action to do now. Now, actually, this particular picture shows that you don't really keep the sequence of percepts. If you look at this picture, you're not keeping the sequence of percepts. It'll only consider, do I have a car on my left? Do I have a car on my right? Do I have a car in front of me? And do I have a pole in front of me? And looking at all these features, I will decide brake, don't brake, change lane, whatever. Yes. That's a good point. So the point is, this picture is actually, in one way, it's richer than this picture. This picture actually had percept sequence in terms of the raw images and the raw voice signals, the raw sound signals. Except it had it for t equal to 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. This picture is higher level than this picture in one sense, because it only has features, not signals, but it's actually less expressive in another sense. It's forgotten its history. Okay? So, in fact, there was a reason why I was talking about this example of there's a car behind me at t equal to 0, t equal to 1, t equal to 3, t equal to 4, there's no car behind me. Normally, that doesn't mean that aliens abducted the car. Normally, it means they just went into your blind spot. Okay, so in general, that's exactly the time you should be more worried, and you should make sure that there is no car before you change lanes. Okay, and so we keep track of the way the world evolves over a period of time. Okay, so in a way, keeping the entire sequence would have given you that information. So simple reflex agent just looks at the world as it is right now and makes an action. Okay, at the minimum, survival requires that you keep track of the state information, not just the current snapshot of the world, but how the world evolved up to this point. One way of doing it is essentially having the sequences of all the high-level feature percepts you got. Another way is to actually keep all that information as part of the state of the world that you are tracking. It's the internal state that you are tracking. There was some raised hand. Yes.
Like by the survival, what do you mean by survival?
So what's interesting actually is, in the previous slide, in this slide, you always just look at the world and decide what action to do now. To some extent, one question that you guys all looked at is, well, you need to remember what happened in the previous time points to be able to decide what action to do. That's fine. But what's more is, you also need to know where you want to be to decide what action to do now. Right? The world doesn't tell you where you want to be. Okay, your goals are your goals. Just because the road is free doesn't mean you keep going on the road. I mean, if your exit comes, you're supposed to take it. But that's your goal. Okay, so in fact, these simple reflex rules, even if you are writing the reflex rules, right, oftentimes those rules essentially are very easy to write for survival. So at least don't get under the car. Okay? But as that Reebok advertisement used to say, apparently Americans don't just want to survive, they want to succeed. So if you want to write the, an agent which actually follows goals, right, how do you deal with goal-following behavior, goal-seeking behavior in this kind of simple reflex agent? You didn't ask me that question. The way you would wind up doing, essentially, is you'll make goal also an extra feature. Okay? And so you would wind up saying, if this is the state, if these are the things that are true in the world, and this is my goal, then do this action. If these are the things that are true in the world and this is my goal, then do this action. So you just increase. If there are 15 goals, you basically multiply the table by 15 times. For each of the goals, you'd wind up saying exactly what to do. Ultimately, that's what you're doing. Okay? So in general, simple reflex agents are easier to write if there's just a single goal that you have all the time, such as survive. And that's because then you'll just have one table. Okay? So that's why I'm saying even that survival is hard if you don't keep track of your previous state, the previous state through which the environment evolved. Even the survival is hard. Okay? So that's why you wind up keeping, essentially you would need to either do this, which is a sequence of all the percepts, or this, which I'll try to argue to you, that is a more sophisticated and more compact representation of percept sequence information. Okay? What you're doing here is essentially you need to keep track of the state of the world that you think you are in, okay? And you also have knowledge about how the world evolves. So for example, if you have seen car behind you, car behind you, car behind you, and no car, is it possible that just cars disappear or not? In your world, if cars can disappear, if it's like a video game and cars can just disappear, bloop, then it's okay. You don't need to take you just take the percept at its face value. If on the other hand, for every disappearance, there should be an explanation, which is what the kind of world we live in, it must be the case that you have to ask yourself, did I pass a exit? In which case, maybe this guy took an exit and went away. If the no exit has been passed, and the car disappeared, and it was a nice big, long road, and the car disappeared, before starting to worry about aliens, you should worry about the possibility that this car is in your blind spot. Where does that information get written? It gets written here. How does the world evolve? How does the world that you live in evolve? You have some information, not the complete information, but some partial information about how is the world supposed to go from state to state. And the reason I made this whole point and you agreed with me is because all of us drive on the similar roads where cars don't just disappear. There must be an explanation. Yes?
How do you generate the knowledge about
the world? We'll talk about that. Okay, right now we are talking about how do you generate this table? We'll talk about all this in a minute, but for now we'll just talk about what needs to be going into the program. Okay? If you want to put stuff into the program, then this might well be the kinds of things that you would wind up doing. The state information, how the world evolves, and also information about what my actions do. So for example, they use to be a car on my right hand side. And then I change my lane into the right hand lane. Okay, there is no car in my right hand side, on my right hand side. Maybe I'm, the lane closest to the shoulder. So this guy is no longer on my right, he's in my back. Okay, how did I figure that out? It has something to do with my understanding of how my actions change my world. My actions change the world, not my world. Okay? So you need information about how does the world evolve just by itself, and what sort of effects does my actions have on the world. Okay? So you need these three extra pieces of information. If you have that, I argue that it's as good as having, so you could actually, in this particular case, you could avoid this occlusion problem, at least in the taxi agent case. Okay? And in general, this together allows the agent to keep track of how the world has been evolving, and with respect to that information, it takes the current snapshot and it can make it as the basis for its decision as to which action to do. Okay? Again, these are fairly high-level discussions. We'll come back to these, but the reason this is interesting to me is if you think this is the architecture of the intelligent agent, then all I need to do is to write programs for this. I need to do two important things. One is, how do I convert signals to symbols, which is basically how do I convert sensory information into higher level features. That's one important thing. The second important thing is, how do I write these condition action rules? Just how do I put tables together? Write big tables and hash into them. Okay, of course, there is a question of where did I get these tables? We'll worry about that a little later. Okay, so in terms of if somebody gives this table, writing it will not, all you have to do is just represent this table in your memory. Okay, but the moment you came here, so that would have been a very boring course, because you're already, well, actually this problem is pretty darn hard, but this is kind of boring. You know, you just are writing a big table. But now you have this, you have to talk about how to represent the state, how to represent your knowledge about how the world evolves, how to represent the knowledge you have about how actions, what your actions do to the world. Okay? The representation issues. The moment I have representation issues, this picture is the first time we are arguing that we need explicit models of the environment. You don't just react to the environment, you also have internal models of the environment that you are in. And the moment you have models of the environment, you have to discuss how they are represented. You could have black box models, which we'll be talking first, where essentially all you would do is, it's a piece of code, and you would say, I am in this state, what are the new states I could get into? And it will tell you new set of states. That code will tell you new set of states. Okay, this is what we'll do in problem solving agents. Okay, which is basically how search works. Or you could have models written in some higher level language, such as logical, probabilistic logical representation. And whenever you have those models, then for each of these, you need representation as well as reasoning. So you need to write the language, so you need to talk about semantics of how to represent what you know in a language. And having written what you know in a language, you should be able to ask, is given whatever I know, is it true that X is also true? Okay, that's the inference, that's the reasoning part. So this picture brings us to representation and reasoning as needed for dealing with, as two important things that you need to do to deal with agent design. Okay, and so this sort of also tells us, when I talk about search, you will be thinking about why we are doing search. It's a way of representing the background knowledge. And when you're talking about logic and probabilistic reasoning, you again remember with respect to this picture, why we remember that. And then having said that, the next part is, before you just condition action rules essentially compiled the goal seeking behavior. I told you that you sort of can compile goal seeking behavior into condition action rules. So if this is all the information about the world, plus this is G1 is your goal, you must do action A1. If G2 is your goal, you must do action A2, and so on. Since we are essentially converting a huge number of percept sequences into a more compact, potentially compact representation about a small model of the world, you might as well consider asking, how can I make this also smaller? How can I make this also smaller? And one way is essentially you have enough information. In fact, it turns out that look at the difference between this, which has this block, and this, where these three guys came in, everything else remained the same, to the next agent, where everything is the same except instead of a table, you just have the goals that you have. You just represent the goals. Okay, and what you would do is, since you have enough information about how the world evolves and what your actions do, you can use that same information to ask yourself, if I'm here and I like to be there, what must my action be such that I will make progress towards going there? Okay, and in goal seeking behavior, so what the world is like right now, and notice that what the world is like right now is not just a function of the sensors. It's a function of the sensors and the internal state that you have been tracking. This is what allowed you to say that even though the car in the right lane disappeared, it's not disappeared out of my world, it's just in my occlusion spot probably. Okay? Yes. Because if you actually change the lane and you got into the right lane, now the guy who is supposed to be in the right lane, behind you in the right lane, is no longer going to be behind you in the right lane. They would be somewhere else. That's because you are able to change. It's just like if I'm here right now, I see you here, Now I turned like this, the guy disappeared. My God, he didn't disappear. He's this side. And the only way I figured that is because I said, when I turn, the world doesn't turn with me. So that's why you need that. Okay? And then the next one is, this is how the world is right now. And then this one tells us, using the same knowledge, what will it be if I were to do an action A? And using that, given the goals I have, I can reason out what action must I do such that I'll eventually get to the goals. Okay? And in general, the way you do this reasoning is either planning or theorem proving or essentially it's again the reasoning aspect. Okay? Search, for example. In a problem-solving agent, you would figure out the sequence of operators that you should do by doing the search. In planning too, you do the search, except you wind up doing it in a state which has more structure. We'll see that in a minute as we go on. And in things like, if you actually wind up representing all you know in logic or probabilistic reasoning, probabilistic knowledge, then you can ask, what must be my action, first action, such that eventually I would be able to reach where I need to reach. Okay, from those of you who may, know some of this word, situation calculus, you can throw in all you know about the world into situation calculus, which is a particular type of first order logic. And ask the theorem prover, is there a world where what I want to have true would be true? And the theorem prover would say yes, because if you were to do this action and this action and this action and this action, you would then be able to exhibit a world where the goal you want is going to be true. So that got your sequence of actions to do, you just start doing them in the reverse order. Okay? And then, we can go farther and say, well, I may not actually have goals, because goals can be, individual goals can be competing, right? And so I might actually have something more like a utility, which is sort of telling me for various types of the states of the world, how good are they for me? So I would say, well, getting an A in this course and still being alive, certain value, okay? Getting an A in this course posthumously, certain other value, and so on and so forth, okay? And based on this, then you can decide what would be your best first action, such that eventually you get to a state of the world which is most good for you. Or even, you would go through good states. Remember that, in fact, I mentioned this to you earlier, goals kind of make you think as if the last state you reach is where all the action is. If you reach the good state in the end. But then we all read, all these proverbs saying the journey is important. It's not the destination, it's the journey. And in fact, it's true, because if a taxi agent gets you to your home, but you are holding on to your dear life during the entire trip, not knowing whether you're going to die or actually make it to your home, it's not a good journey, because you went through states that were hair-raising. And if you are in Disney World, you might not mind doing that, but if you are in a taxi, you may not want to do that. So in essence, you went through states, you may have actually, this view of the agent allows you to talk about the different types of states of the world and how good are they for you. How good are they for you? And as you go through these states, you collect rewards, happiness, at each state. Okay? And in some sense, the amount of the happiness you collect is a function of the happiness you collected in each of the states, sequence of states. Which makes it much more interesting. In from that point of view, I'll get to you. From that point of view, the difference between this model and this model is, in the previous one, if I tell you that I went through sequences S0 up to S1000, whether or not it's a good behavior for me was dependent only on the last state. That's just a special case of whether or not it's a good behavior being dependent on what you collected in each of the states. But there are actually interesting problems if you want to define the goodness of your behavior in terms of the function of all the states whose utilities you go through. There are some technical problems that we'll talk about once I answer this guy's question.
Did you say that
It depends. It depends. So it's a very good question. I actually normally say this, which is, you would think that chess is a kind of a scenario where all that matters is winning the game. Right? That's it. You know, you win under the time considerations, you are a champion. If not, you are not. But then there is this issue of some chess champions are seen to be, you know, people with insight, people who have panache, who can do nice, you know, moves, and certain other chess champions who don't seem to, right? And so presumably you are making a distinction. It's not just how you won. You will get your, you know, medal for winning, but if you won it with panache, then you will be remembered early, longer. And you know, one of the classic things that I'll keep mentioning in this class normally is, if Garry Kasparov is playing your 2-year-old niece, right, or nephew, you know, I'm nothing against nieces, and he still takes for each move like 25 minutes, right, we'll say, what a crazy man, or more colorful ways of saying that, okay? He would win, of course. But the, come on, I mean, you know, this is a 2-year-old nephew, right? And, you know, we haven't said they came from alien chess world. So you are not playing the game in a way that will make everybody happy. And so there is, even in chess, it could be that the states you go through would matter.
Couldn't that just be part of the goal?
Yeah, I mean, all I'm saying is the goal now is a more complex thing, which is get through, what's the right goal? The goal is get through good states in your life. Enjoy the journey, and of course the journey has to go through good places, okay? But you also have to end in a good place. So if I say the utility, the overall utility of a behavior is some function of all the utilities of all the states that you went through, then you can start having, you know, the ability to capture that. Yes. It's a good point. So what I mentioned is exactly that. Kasparov, I mean, if you want to win, then it turns out that min-max analysis is the best thing to do, which is winning is the same as not losing. And so avoid losing, and then you will win eventually, or the other guy will get bored to death and leave. Okay. But there are ways of winning which take into account. In fact, one of the things we'll see, and you know, is that normal game playing assumes that you know how good the game is, you know how good each of the positions are for you, so does your opponent. And that just as you are trying to make a move that's maximally good for you, your opponent is trying to make a move that's maximally bad for you. This is risk-averse behavior. This is totally risk-averse behavior, which makes sense. It makes sure that you don't lose. It doesn't make sure that you would win fast. It doesn't make sure that you would win while, you know, exploiting the possible limitations of your opponent. So when Kasparov is, you know, playing with your 2-year-old nephew or niece, he should have realized that these guys wouldn't have read up all the books about opening positions and closing positions yet, unless they're accelerated readers. And so we can take some chances with these people and bluff them. Okay, so they might win faster. Okay. So this is called the utility theoretic agent, and the idea is you separated goals into, essentially, rather than say goals are the properties of the last states, you're saying essentially all the states I go through have utilities. And my interest now is no longer do an action which eventually gets me to the state where all the goals are true, but rather do an action which will eventually make me go through other states that will increase my expected reward. Okay, so to do that, essentially, let me talk about what we are talking about here is, each time, you know, for the simplest case, think of, you know, episodic agents. Okay, so each time the agent starts and it goes through a bunch of states, S0 all the way up to S1000, let's say. And for each of these states, you have utilities. Now, you can ask me, where did you get those utilities? And I'll say the same place where you got the rest of the models about the world. You get to decide your utilities, okay? And having figured, or somebody tells you, you know, for example, some of the utilities are pushed into you. I say you have to pass this course. So that's, you wind up, if to the extent you worry about me, you would give low utility to a state where you would wind up failing the course, and high utility to a state where you wind up passing the course. But then you also internally have your utilities, like every Friday I should watch a movie. Now nobody is forcing you unless you are in a film school, but that's part of your utility matrix. So if you went through an entire semester just passing the course without ever having seen a movie, maybe it's not a good course for you. You did get the utility of the last state, but rest all your weekends were sort of not very good. Okay? So you would wind up doing all of them, and these guys wind up putting different competing pressures on what you should be doing at a given point of time. Okay? Which is why you need a good search or an inference algorithm which will tell you what's the best action you should do given all these competing forces, competing pressures on what you must be doing. Now, yes?
The utility agents have like an end goal as well?
That could be. See, end goal is just part, utility agent, everything that we did there is, the first one is a specialization of the second one is a specialization of the third one, the last one is a specialization of the everybody.
But it seems like it could lead you down a great path, but a great path that never actually reaches the end state.
It doesn't matter. If your utility metric is in such a way that it doesn't really matter whether or not. So I want to go to Grand Canyon. So I put my kids and then start going towards Grand Canyon. I say, really, we want to go through a scenic route. And then we enjoy the whole day, and then it becomes too late in the evening. So I don't go to Grand Canyon, I come home. Who is to tell whether I had fun or not? Do you understand what I'm saying? So all I care is whether or not the expected reward, the reward that you accrued by going through these states, is that high. And in fact, if you want it to be optimal, is that the maximal reward you could have accrued? Now, whenever I'm saying this, there is a very tricky point I'm making, which is if you have utility, 1 for this, 1.5 for this, 2 for this, 3 for this, et cetera, all the way to the end, what is the utility of the entire sequence? I can talk about utilities for individual states, but how do I define the utility of a sequence given the utility of the states? The simplest idea is sum. Just sum them. Okay? The problem with summing is what? If you live long enough, it looks as if you'll always be right. If you live long enough, there'll be infinite number of states. Even if each of your states is like epsilon, infinity times epsilon is going to be infinite. Right? So there has to be, in fact, in particular, there's a degeneracy. In fact, the utility winds up being unbounded. And so pretty much anything you do looks like it's good, as long as you just keep doing stuff. Okay? So if you happen to consider behaviors for fixed horizons, that means you only consider behavior over 1,000 states, then summation is fine. Those are called finite horizon cases. But if you consider indefinite or infinite horizon cases, then you need to worry about the possibility that summation of small utilities winds up just taking over. And so then the question will become, how do you combine, I'll get to you, how do you combine the individualities of the states such that the sum will still be finite, first of all? If nothing else, at least it should be finite. Okay? And secondly, after it becomes finite, maybe I'll try to make sense of how I wound up making it finite. Okay? A simple way of making any large sequence of numbers sum to a finite quantity is to multiply them by gamma power I, where in the first, take a number gamma, which is between 0 and 1, and multiply the first number by gamma power 0, second number by gamma power 1, gamma power 2, gamma power 3, etc., all the way. If you do that, essentially the gamma is just killing the later guys to become smaller and smaller. So that you can easily see that in essence what you're doing is it's going to be dominated by the geometric sequence. And the geometric sequence, 1 plus gamma squared plus gamma power 3, etc., does converge for gamma being between 0 and 1 strictly. You know this from old times. So I can do this, and I can make sure that I got the numbers to add up to finite. The question is, does it make any sense? The answer is yes. In a way, it does make sense, because suppose I asked you the following question. Do you want $1 now or $10 later? $1 now or $10 later? Most of you would ask me how later is later. If not, you've been dropped on your head, right? Most of you are going to ask me how later is later. And based on your utility metric, this guy will say how later is later, and if I say it's, you know, at most 1 month, and you say, okay, I'll take $10. Then we know that this guy, for him, $10 1 month later is still more useful than $1 now. Somebody else say, 1 week later, no, I'll take the $1 now. And my son will say, $10 tomorrow morning, he'll say, I'll take $1 now. Right? You can't trust me. Okay. So the point is, each of us have different ways of discounting future rewards with respect to current rewards. Okay? But we do it. As part of living, we discount future rewards with respect to current rewards. Okay? So in fact, all I did here can be seen as discounting future rewards. And the guy who does, so my son obviously has a gamma which is high or low. My son wants $1 today rather than $10 tomorrow. Gamma is what? High or low? Very low. For this guy, gamma is higher. But all of them, gamma is less than 1, because if it's greater than 1, then the discounting, you know, discounting idea works, but it doesn't sum to a finite quantity. Okay? So what we will do is, this was the last but one picture of the intelligent agent we saw. This is the one with just goals, not utilities. Okay. But even with respect to this, you can make sense of what we'll do in the course. All of these require representation and reasoning. So the representation aspect is motivated. We'll talk about logic, propositional and first order logic, probabilistic logic. The reason we talk about it is we need some way of representing this stuff. Okay? We will talk about search, planning, inference, which is logical resolution, Bayesian net inference, all of which are needed, because having the knowledge, you want to be able to ask, if I were to do this action, where would I be, and what action should I do now? I looked at you, I'll see. Okay? For that, you need the inference information. Oftentimes, the representation and inference go hand in hand. So when we look at black box representations, we look at search. When we look at logical representations, we will look at resolution. When we look at probabilistic representations, we will look at Bayesian net inference, for example. Okay? And then finally, you would talk about learning, which is, where do these models come from? Where do these models come from? And the best idea we have is either you write them in, or somehow they keep becoming better. Now, of course, when they're becoming better, where did they start? If they started with zero, then it's completely emergent. So all the knowledge that you figured out about your world is completely emergent. If you started with some knowledge and you kept learning more and more, then there's not much of a difference between this picture and plus learning added on top. Okay. In general, learning should learn all of these. How to do state representations, how to learn how the world evolves, how to learn what my actions do on the world. All of this knowledge, you need learning. Okay? I know I have two people asking me questions, but before that, I have a question for you, which is, how many of you think, for humans, human babies who come into the world, how many of you think that this stuff is mostly zero? When the babies come into this world, do they come with very little knowledge about how their world works? Or do you think they come into the world with a huge amount of knowledge? We clearly agree that babies learn, right? We all learn. We somehow keep thinking learning is like the most important thing, you know, intelligent entities can do. The real question is, do human babies come into the world with more or less zero knowledge about the world they live in? Or do they come into the world with more or less huge amount of knowledge about the world and then just learn a little bit more? Which is more closer to the truth?
Closer to zero.
What?
They
think of something like language. The kids learn language up front, right? Very early on. How much of the language knowledge, linguistic knowledge, is hard coded for human babies and how much isn't?
Sure. I think if anything, they start out with too much knowledge conflicting and then they prune it down.
So this is important for all of us to understand, which is that babies come into the world with a huge amount of knowledge. From where you think, those of you who thought close to zero, you'd be surprised at how much knowledge humans come into the world. Okay? We know a humongous amount of knowledge about how languages work. We have essentially a universal grammar. The best understanding we have is we have essentially a universal grammar for all the languages, all the human languages of the world built in. And all the baby then does is, based on what it hears around it, it starts tuning. Ah, looks like this is sort of English stuff. This sort of, you know, and then it starts speaking English. Okay? That's where we are. In fact, there are only 104 possible guttural sounds we can make, given our vocal cords. So only 104 or so, I may not be correct at the exact number, only about 104 or so phonemes that we can actually articulate. Now, all human languages are going to wind up using these phonemes. Not every language uses all the phonemes. Okay? So, for example, there are language, in my language, there are phonemes like nya, or la. And in my relative's language, which is, my language is Telugu, where you have la and nya. And I can make huge fun of you when you try to do this, most of you. And then my language doesn't have a. I can't say pack when I was born. I mean, not born. I mean, when I started speaking Telugu, I didn't know how to say pack, P-A-C-K. So I would approximately say something like P-Y-A-C-K, pyak. And in fact, in all many Indian languages, pack is written as P-Y-A-C-K, pyak. And you can laugh at me, but then I get to laugh at you when you try to say gnyan by writing G-Y-A-N, which doesn't sound at all like gnyan I know. And gnyan, by the way, means knowledge, which means you don't have knowledge. And then there are languages in Africa which make these sounds as part of the speaking. All these phonemes together, there are only 104 of them. When a baby is born, baby is able to make any of these phonemes. Imagine, otherwise, this baby was supposed to be born in in Mesa, and then last minute you took a flight and went off to Hyderabad, and the baby is all completely confused. It comes out and has no clue how to speak. That's not the way it's going to happen, right? It does not have that problem because it has the ability to speak all the phonemes. And then, as it goes on, there are studies showing that all babies can make all the phonemes, and as they see the phonemes being said around them, they stop speaking the rest of the phonemes. So they become dumber. They used to be, you know, sort of Renaissance people, and they become dumber as they grow up. So it's opposite of what you were thinking. Now, who gave them the knowledge? Obviously not the ultrasound, right? How did they get all this knowledge into their brains?
Brain chemistry.
Brain chemistry, no, but I mean, overall, what process gave them the knowledge? Or Pat Robertson, whichever, you know, you believe in. Again, evolution essentially got us prepared for all this knowledge. Now you might say, well, this is just language. Everything else babies have no clue, they have to figure out. If you drop a baby that's just born into a swimming pool, I'm hoping that you already taken care of your problems with social security, I mean the police force, etc., so that they won't put you behind the bars for doing this. If you drop a baby into a swimming pool, shallow swimming pool hopefully, they will make the right moves to stay afloat in the first few days. After the first few days, if you drop them, they'll sink like a stone. And then you'll have to put them in the Swim Kids USA and pay a whole bunch of money until they remember back what they knew when they were born. This is true. I'm not making this up. When the Swim Kid USA part is making up, but the rest is true. Okay? There are studies showing that babies, when they are born, when you take them banana smell and rotten egg smell and put them next to their noses, you know, you can do all these fun things as long as people allow you to do, right? They really look unhappy when they get the rotten egg smell, and they look happy when they get the banana smell. Why? They're just born. They have never seen a banana in their life. They've never seen a rotten egg in their life. Why? Again, we are born with this circuitry. I'm not saying all you do in your life is just nature, but don't assume that we come with zero knowledge. Tabula rasa is as silly as everything is pre-wired and nothing can change as you live. Okay? So from my point of view, those of you who said we should only be looking at emergent behaviors, there is no point in thinking about any background knowledge. Well, even we have background knowledge when we come into the world. Certain types you wind up learning, certain types we have. Yes?
Turning down a large general knowledge to more specific knowledge is emergent behavior. To learn and hone to what's most important is emergent, it's not.
No, I don't know how to define emergent. I think the simplest way I was saying is you don't put any knowledge and you wind up getting it just by working in the world. There are certain types of knowledge that we get like that, but certain other types are already built in. So all I'm saying is, we don't have to worry that we are taking a knowledge-based view of the agent. You know, because two reasons. One, in fact, it is reasonable to have background knowledge. And two, we can work on learning algorithms which can basically let us start with smaller and smaller amounts of this and increase it as we go on. Okay? One other thing, by the way, there are studies showing that little babies have depth perception, of course. I mean, first of all, it's surprising enough because little babies, for the longest time in their life, think that the entire world is part of their body. They don't differentiate between you and them. They have eyes, but they don't have a way of figuring out that you are outside of me. You know, this entire thing is my body right now. Okay? Given that, so one of the experiments they have done is if you put on a glass surface, you know, which suppose you have, let's say, here is a table, I put a big glass pane on this, and I make the little kids try to go over this when they, I guess, start trying to crawl or something, okay? By that time, they don't know enough about falling down. And yet, they instinctively avoid going into this direction. They go back. Why? Again, all I'm saying is that those of you who think there is not much background knowledge built in, you should rethink, because there is enough background knowledge built in. And those of you who think everything is built in and there's nothing you get to do, you shouldn't really be wasting your time taking courses. Because your life has already been decided. So why are you wasting your time, you know? So I am assuming you don't do the second part, so I'm also making sure that you don't do the first one. Questions from two people. You had still any questions?
This is from a little bit earlier on the discounting. I was thinking of an idea that you might be able to generalize a little bit. It actually might make sense in some cases to have a huge difference, like $200 now could be way more important than, say, $10,000. If you have absolutely nothing and you need the 200 for something that will keep you alive or keep you employed, or I know that utility is more than just money in the sense of AI, but
so I mean, all I'm suggesting is, again, these are models, and we actually can look at this is a model for handling infinite state sequences or indefinite horizon cases. But this is not the only model. There are models such as average reward over periods of time. And there are also, it's also clear that you may not be able to have a single gamma for every problem. As you said, your gamma would depend upon whether or not you desperately need money for an iPod, like end of the month. As against, you're feeling extremely hungry right now, so I could use the $1 right now. Okay, so you do change it. But all I'm saying is, think about the fact that when you start thinking of goals in terms of sequences of states, you need to worry about how to define cumulative utility of a sequence of states. And this is one mathematical abstraction that you can use, discounting. And by the way, we will talk about what are called Markov decision processes, which essentially are made to, so when you have your goals are defined in terms of just the utility matrix for individual states, then there is no single goal, right? Then what all you have to do is, you have to essentially say, if I'm in this state, I must do this. If I'm in this state, I must do this. Such that if I keep doing this, over a period of time, the expected reward I get to collect would be maximized. Expected cumulative reward I get to collect would be maximized. And that is a Markov decision process, and we will look at those too. Markov decision process winds up being a general case of direct search, going from graph search, which is going from an initial node to a goal node. Okay? Yes? Well, we'll talk about search algorithms later. I mean, there's lots of details. That's what the semester is for. Okay? I mean, basically, we at least have to figure out how to do exhaustive search, and then we have to figure out how to do faster search. Much of the course would be in terms of, so if I know, for example, here is the state I am in, and here is the state I need to go to, you at least know that you can write it as a graph search. Then the question becomes, how do I, now that I figured out I can do a graph search, the question becomes, how do I do graph search fast? That's the next part of today's class and next class, which is basically heuristic search. And the same thing for MDPs too. Once you figure out that when you have utilities for individual states and the total utility you get is a sort of a function of, cumulative function of the utilities that you get from the individual states, and you are trying to maximize the expected reward that you would get over the period of time that you live, okay, how do you solve it? The answer is you can model it as a Markov decision process, where essentially it's not a path, it's just a policy which tells you if you are in this state, do this action, if you are in this state, do this action. That's a policy, okay? And once you find that, once you decide that, of the many policies you can have, there is a policy which is optimal. We'll say why it is optimal. In the sense, it will wind up maximizing the expected reward. And there are exhaustive ways of finding the optimal policies, and there are heuristic ways of finding something close to optimal policy, or there are heuristic ways of finding optimal policies too. Just as in a graph search that we will talk about, we'll say that we can do exhaustive search, which is this blind search, breadth first and depth first. Or you can start doing informed search, which uses heuristics to decide which paths to go on. And depending on the property of the heuristic, something called admissibility of the heuristic, if you have admissibility, when you're done, you can be sure that you got the optimal path. And if you don't have admissibility, when you're done, you know you're done, but you don't know whether it's optimal or not. Which, by the way, since I'm here, let me point out one point for you, which is optimality is a global property. The only way you will know something is optimal is by design. You have proved a theorem saying when I'm done, it'll be optimal. If a friend comes to you and says, hey, this is a correct way of going from here to LA, you can check it. You can check whether or not those are reasonable things. You know, here's the correct way of going from here to LA. You know, first you use your wings to fly to airport and so on and so forth, he says, and you know, oh, that makes no sense. You don't have wings, you don't get to fly, okay? But if he says, you go from here to the airport by, a cab and then take Southwest Airlines and then go to Ontario and then go from Ontario to LA by Southwest Airlines again, you can check whether it's correct or not. If this guy says, this is the optimal way of going from here to LA, you can't trust him. The only way you can trust him or her is to have analyzed the rest of the possible ways of going from here to LA and prove to yourself exhaustively that this is really the best. Okay? So getting optimal anything is not just, is harder than getting correct anything, because you have to essentially ensure that by comparison, there is no other solution which is better. And when we go to, for example, the search algorithms or the MDPs, we will wind up proving that under certain conditions, it's going to be optimal. Okay, and as long as those conditions are satisfied, you just know that it's optimal because you proved it. You can't just say, well, I reached the goal and I used the heuristic, it must be optimal. That's not the case. Okay. Why do I want optimality? I might want optimality in any scenarios, in the sense that even if I have uncertainty in the world, even if I have uncertainty in the world, in the sense the actions I do may or may not have the right effect. You know, you don't know exactly when they'll have what effects. And even if I have these kinds of general scenarios where you have utilities for all over the states, it is in fact, you can argue in two ways. One is from a computer science point of view, you can actually ask whether or not the problem is hard. And the hardness of the problem might be very different if you care about optimality versus not care about optimality. So just from the algorithm's point of view, it's important. And secondly, ignoring optimality willy-nilly makes no sense, because you should at least know how to get to the optimum before giving up on optimum. Okay, so in fact, I'll point this out multiple times. You need to know how you could get an optimal solution if you need, so that when you are not getting to the optimum, at least you have either some bounds or some understanding as to how far you are from the best that you could do. Okay, this is a game we will play all through the course. In fact, there are psychological studies which basically the guy, how many of you know the only computer scientist who ever got a Nobel Prize? Nobel Prizes are not given to computer science people, which is really sad for me, but there is one guy who was in a computer science department who got a Nobel Prize. Who is that? Herbert Simon. Why is Herbert Simon famous? He was one of the three people whose pictures I showed you in the first class. He was, along with Marvin Minsky and Alan Newell, Herbert Simon is considered three of the most important people who are instrumental in starting the field of AI. Okay, so it almost looks like Herbert Simon got Nobel Prize for AI. So there is like a escape clause for AI people. So I still have hope. You know, computer science won't get Nobel Prizes, but AI people will. Unfortunately, he didn't get Nobel Prize for computer science at all. He is actually a Renaissance man. He is a psychologist, he's an economist, and he's a computer scientist. And he got his Nobel Prize for organization, his work in organizational psychology. And he proved, quote unquote, in economic terms, I mean not experimentally, that human organizations do not optimize their performance, which I'm sure all of you know. You know, having looked at the human organization. But he basically showed empirically that the Milwaukee municipality, he did studies over them in as to how they make decisions, and he basically pointed out that what they do is satisficing. He made this whole entire world called satisficing, which doesn't exist, and word keeps telling me it's spelling error. But for this course, satisficing is fine. Satisficing is just get what is required. Now the interesting thing is, while he's right in that, one way you can make satisficing solutions closer and closer to optimal is to compile some of the required conditions for optimality as required conditions for feasibility. Okay, so what I'm trying to say is, within the field, people do mention this differentiation between what should we or should we not care about optimality. And I think for the reasons I mentioned, we would care about optimality even if we don't necessarily build agents that would, if they are not optimal, we'll throw them out the window. Any other question? Yes?
So one way that it might be correct to think of an example of a correct versus optimal, say you're trying to get from point A to point B on the map, how is an example? An example of a correct solution would just be any path. That you could follow in a beta test of all the on the road. And an optimal would be whatever your optimizing course is.
Exactly. Yeah. So first of all, there are two issues when you talk about optimum. What are your optimality criteria? Sometimes, in fact, there is no single objective. You know, as I mentioned in the travel scenario, right? What is an optimal plan for going from here to LA? Depends on what are you trying to optimize, cost or time or some specific combination of them. That's point one. having figured that out, then there is a point two, which is having figured out how good each plan is in a numeric sense. You give a real number for each plan, saying this is 2.3 good, that is 4.7 good. Okay, how do you know that the plan that you have in front of you is the best you can do? The only way you can do it, if you want to prove optimality, normally you have to enumerate all the solutions and show that this is the only solution that's optimal. Okay, so optimality is more interesting in an algorithm design point of view. What? It's a subset of correct. Yeah. I agree. Completely. Completely. Yes. Except you can change the correctness. So notice that you are the guy who said, or somebody said, if I was going to Grand Canyon and I don't finally reach Grand Canyon, right? Is that correct solution or not? Well, it depends on my goal matrix, my utility matrix. It is in fact, you might start changing. When you start having all goals are soft, you can achieve them or not achieve them, then it winds up being the case that anything you do is a feasible solution. Hanging around is a feasible solution. It's true that I'm not satisfying anybody, but at least I'm satisfying myself. I'm happy. Okay. So of the all the feasible solutions, which is the optimal? Sometimes correctness, just getting to correctness, is very hard. Sometimes correctness comes free. If you make goals, if all the goals you have are required goals, then just getting the correctness is hard. And then that also means that there are only few correct solutions, some of which must be optimal. If on the other hand, all goals are suggestions, it's like 10 commandments or 10 suggestions, right? Then you could decide whether to actually achieve them or not. And so there are many, many more feasible plans, all of which are in some sense correct. But some of them are the optimal ones. Okay? Okay, what I'm going to do is start with the problem solving agents today and continue next class. What problem solving agents do with respect to the discussion we did in goal-based agents is they wind up representing this knowledge, the state of the world, how the world evolves, and what my actions do in terms of opaque pieces of code. Okay. In particular, they will essentially have a structure like this. An agent, essentially, it has a state which is a data structure that makes sense to another program called child generator program. Okay. A child generator program takes the state. So here's what you do. You have a state, start from here, and then you look for the solution, which essentially is the sequence of operations that you do to go from this state to a goal state. Now, whether or not a state is a goal state is not known to you. It's only known to a piece of program called goal test function. Okay? And the goal test function eats a state and says yes or no. If it says yes, it's a goal. If it says no, it's not a goal. And a child generator function takes a state and spits out a list of states. And those are all the children states that you can generate by doing legal operations. Okay? So all you need to write a problem-solving agent is a child generator function and a goal test function. And using them, you can write a search algorithm which will ensure that when the search algorithm terminates and gives you a path from the beginning state to a state which satisfies the goal test, that would be the optimal path. That's what we'll do first. So the important thing here is I don't wind up writing anything explicitly in terms of logic or problem solving, probabilistic logic. Everything I know is in these opaque boxes. A state data structure which only makes sense to two other guys. One guy called goal test function, another guy called child generator function. So what that means is you're making very few commitments about how the problems are represented, which means you're going to be applicable in many, many scenarios. Okay? So here are some examples. So I can say what I'm trying to do is go from Arad to Bucharest. That's the problem I'm trying to solve. Okay? So the states would potentially be the names of the cities. and a child generator function looks at the name of the city and generates all the cities that can be reached by one step by taking an operator. The kind of operators you have here is take this road, this road, this road. Okay? And then finally, reaching the goal test function checks the state and says if it's Bucharest or not. If it's Bucharest, it says yes. If not, it says no. Okay? Here is a different world, which two I can handle the same way, which is I have a very simplified world with two rooms. There may be dirt in both rooms. There may or may not be dirt in both rooms. And there is a vacuum cleaner, Roomba, robotic agent, and what it wants to do is to make sure that there is no dirt in any of the rooms, and once there is no dirt in any of the rooms, it should come back to the right room and sleep. That's what it's supposed to do. That's the goal. Okay? So you can start from any initial state. I'll give you initial state, and then what the robot has to do is to decide what it should do until it reaches the goal state. The kind of actions it can have are shut off, go forward, suck, turn left, turn right. Okay? That's basically what the vacuum agent is going to do. Okay? Now, what are the percepts that it has? What are the percepts it could have? In particular, it could have percepts such as, I bumped into something, there is dirt somewhere, and I am at the home location. These percepts may or may not be there, but if you want percepts at all, that's the kind of sensing that it wants to wind up needing. Okay, and the goals, of course, as I said, I can either write it in terms of you get more points for keeping the room more clean, or I can write it as this is just one time only. You get into the rooms, make sure they're clean, and go back to where you're supposed to be. Okay. In this case, of course, the state information, what are the states? What are the states? These are the states. Okay? Now, this state graph is connected by the actions that you can do to go from one state to other. I would say there is no difference between this and that. Here, too, each node is a state. Each edge is an operator. And you're trying to go from a state to a required state, goal state. So obviously, you can do graph search algorithms on this. Okay? And similarly, here too, here is a state, and here is the goal state. This is what I want to get to. And going from any of these states to this is just a graph search algorithm. And the child generator function would take a state and generate me the new states on the actions that you should do to get to them. That's what the child generator does. And the goal test checks whether or not you are in this state. Okay. Now, this is actually an interesting kind of a scenario where the state really, you can see that the state is made up of a bunch of features. Right? You can actually see that the state is made up of the location of the robot, which can be right or left, and the dirt in room 1, dirt in room 2, which are Boolean variables. There are only three, basically Boolean variables. Location, right, left, dirt in room 1, true, false, dirt in room 2, true, false. So this state really is false, right. That's the state. So the advantage of thinking in that way is in domains like this, actually, even though I can think of this whole thing as a state number 51, a state number 1, or state number 7, I can also say the states themselves are made up in terms of features and the valuations that the features have. Here you have three features. There are three Boolean features. If you have three Boolean features, how many valuations can they have? 2^3, 8. That's why essentially the search graph has 8 nodes here. Now here is an interesting thing, and this is the last one, believe me, you go home after that. If my robot, if I get here, right, goal test needs to know which state it is in. If it basically knows that it actually is in a state where there is no but dirt here, no dirt here, and the robot is in the right hand location, then it knows how to check whether it's goal or not. Suppose my Roomba robot has, you know, design restrictions. We reduced money we spent on it so that we can sell it cheaply, and all this guy knows is whether it is bumped into something or not. No more knowledge. It doesn't know whether there's dirt or not. It doesn't know whether it's in the right room or left room. It only knows whether there is, whether it's bumped into something. In a way, essentially, it no longer knows. In fact, let's assume that it is completely blind. It doesn't know which state it is in. If I tell you that this is the state space and you don't know where you are in this state space, how many possible states could you be in? What? You could be in 8 different states. Okay? If I keep giving you more and more knowledge, it would be subsets of these 8 different states. How many subsets are there for 8 different, a set of size 8? 2 power 8. What is 2 power 8? So there are 256 potential state sets, and you could be on any of them, and you're going from one of them to another of them. Okay? And if you are actually searching in that scenario, your state graph looks more like this. Each state really is a subset of states. And notice that not all subsets are actually feasible. Even though there are 2 power 56 subsets, some of them are not actually feasible. You don't get to them from any legal state. What? Yeah, that's right. Notice there are no 256 states here. It's already small. But what's interesting is, in the worst case, you could have 256 states. And so what I'm trying to say is, look at this. If you have n states, finding a path through that state space would be a graph search in the size, in a graph of size n. But if these n states are made up of v state variables, you really are searching in a graph of size 2 power v. And if you lost all your sight, sound, everything, all the sensors, then even if you have n states, you are effectively in a state space of size 2 power n, which is actually 2 power v. This is a classic way of explaining what happens when you lose eyesight, what happens when you lose sensing. When you lose sensing, the size of the problem has exponentially increased. So your friend with all the sensing knowledge was in a state space of size 2 power v. You could be in a state space of size 2 power v. And the way computer science students get nightmares in the night is what? You are supposed to wake up sweating if you ever see 2 power n in your nightmare. That's the nightmare thing, okay? 2 power n is really bad. And we have, once you lose your eyesight, you have 2 power n, where n is the number of state variables. But it too is still a graph search. It's just a graph search in a bigger scenario. Okay? We'll stop here. We'll come back next class and go quickly through some of the search algorithms that you already know for these kinds of problems.